brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Benyar, America's right-wing religious fanatic, homophobic, anti-choice talk show host. Feel free to call in 1-800-8-NYART, 1-800-836-9278, broadcasting live over the web, hopefully making it into Israel. Now, the web goes into Israel, right? Israel, where Palestinians are giving a new meaning to the term suicide bomber. A new meaning. It has come to mean the terrorist who blows himself up while making a bomb in his own house. Now that's a suicide bomber. You know, what have there been over 700 people killed in the Intifada since last fall? The majority are Palestinians. But I think the body counts might be approximately equal if you count only Jews and the Palestinians killed by their own suicide bombs in their own homes. It's a real tragedy. The Palestinian man and his two small children who were killed last night when their house blew up. And the Israeli army, you know, they're pretty good. The IDF, Israeli Defense Force, they're pretty good at saying when some Palestinian gets killed and they say, yeah, we killed him. It was a good shot. But then when they say, when a house blows up and they say, we didn't do it, they did it. And the Palestinian spokesman, of course, think, they get irate. But Israel has a lot of credibility here. When they kill somebody, they said, we did it. It was a good shot. And in this case, this was in the town of Rafah. And they said, we didn't do it. They did it. And it turns out, well, there's good evidence that the guy was a terrorist making a bomb, preferably to blow up women and children at maybe a grocery store. But you know, the Tel Aviv disco, remember, over 20 people dead and a lot more wounded and maimed? And then the pizza parlor in Jerusalem, 15 dead, more than 100 maimed and wounded. And a Haifa cafe, another suicide bombing, 20 injured. Real tragedies going on constantly. And what's going to happen when Israel makes a defensive move and goes in and takes out somebody building bombs or ordering bomb attacks? The Bush administration condemns Israel. And that is tragic. It's not that Israel is the perfect nation. Certainly America's not the perfect nation, but you have the right to defend yourself from terrorist attacks. And what likely will happen, it's becoming increasingly obvious or likely that Israel will go in a large-scale invasion of Palestinian territories and destroy Arafat's police state machine and perhaps consolidate their holdings, their settlements, their homes, and simplify their border with Palestinian areas and build a wall. So we'll see what happens. But we're going to go to the phones now. You can call us at 1-800-8-NYART, 1-800-836-9278. And if you get a busy signal, you could try 303-463-1707. We've got that up on the web at kgov.com. But we're going to go to Jeff in Indiana. Welcome, Jeff.
Hi, Bob.
How are you?
Real good. A couple of months ago, you started a topic that I was really interested in, and then you got sidetracked, and you never got back to it.
Yeah.
And that topic was, at what point in sports does violence cross the line to the point where it should be considered a criminal act?
Right. And I think we talked about that because of a hockey game.
Right.
Where some player, what did he do? He took a stick to another player's head?
I believe so.
Yeah, I seem to recall that. And I had stated that guy should be charged with assault. And he should be. That's a crime.
What about, say, for example, boxing?
Yeah, boxing is a tough one because the rules of the game are you get to punch each other in the face. That is a tough one. And occasionally people die in the boxing ring.
Yeah.
We had a young pro die here in Colorado just a few months ago. Just a, you know, normal shot to the head, and he was dead.
Yeah.
And, of course, we have a rash of football players dying. Not only we had the one pro a couple weeks ago, but quite a few college students in the last few years, over a dozen. And one high school student, if I heard in the news right while I was on vacation last week, high school student died.
Right. As far as boxing, I'm a big boxing fan, and I basically just consider boxing to be the manly art of self-defense. I don't consider it to be criminal at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I certainly didn't think of boxing as criminal, and I've never got it down on paper, a clean statement of when it becomes criminal.
Yeah.
But I think that the general principles, you know, if you take a hockey stick and hit a player in the head, certainly that's not part of the game.
Right.
If it was part of the game, it shouldn't be, and then the promoters of the game could be charged with a crime.
Right.
But a normal boxing match, of course, everything we do in life is. There's risk involved in virtually everything. And you could have a boxing match, and somebody could have a blood clot that gets jarred loose, and they end up with a stroke, or they die. And so there's risk, but I think I think when people, their adrenaline is racing, and they're on the field, they're in the stadium, and then they run out to the pitcher's mound and throw a punch, that is an assault. I would charge, you know, you clear the bench in a baseball stadium, I'd charge people with crimes, and then they wouldn't do that anymore.
Yeah, I don't know how well you've thought this through,
but
what do you think about the UFC, the Ultimate Fighting Championship?
I've never even heard of that. I thought you meant the United Federation of Chess Players.
Okay. Well, so if you haven't heard about it, I'll drop it.
Okay.
Okay, thanks, Bob.
All right, thank you for your call, Jeff. Appreciate that. 1-800-8-NYART, 1-800-836-9278. The Ultimate, what was that group? Ultimate Fighting Challenge. Bare knuckle. Yeah. Doesn't sound like a good idea. Let's put it that way. Okay. So anyway, you know, what a tragedy. This guy's making a bomb in his backyard in Israel, and he blows his house up, himself up, and his 6-year-old daughter and an 8-year-old son. And this isn't the first time. They're doing this repeatedly over there, the Palestinians. A new meaning to the term suicide bomber. What a mess. What an absolute mess. Tragedy. Okay. Hey, talk about a mess. How about Africa? Well, not the whole continent. But go to the middle of Africa, the Central African Republic. There's an article in the Washington Times out today. African students, this is going to blow your mind. African students are contracting AIDS, the AIDS virus, from their teachers at a high rate. In this article from the Washington Times, there are UN AIDS researchers out there and UNICEF saying this is a huge problem of students getting AIDS from the teachers. And this is going to blow your mind. Guess what percentage of teachers in this country, the teachers who died last year, guess which percentage of them died of AIDS? Now, 300 teachers died of AIDS in the Central African Republic last year. No, I'm sorry. 300 teachers died in total. 85% died from AIDS. That's almost all of them. 85%. And the UN is saying that they think by the year 2005, about half of all teachers in that country will have died from AIDS. And then to make matters worse, the students, it's very common for the students, the female students, to have sex with the male teachers Many of the male teachers are also homos. And they interview, the Washington Times interviews this girl, this 15-year-old girl, and they just found out that her friend was diagnosed as HIV positive, and she had two other friends, age 17, who just died of AIDS recently. And she says, well, they got it from having sex with the teachers, and she said they have sex with the teachers so they'll pass an exam. And the UN is saying this is a huge problem. They say they think 50% of all teachers in the country will die from AIDS by 2005. 85% of the teachers who died last year died from AIDS. Man, AIDS is turning out to be a threat to your normal death causes. You think somebody's going to start protesting unfair treatment of lung cancer and all. So what a mess. All right. And we talked on this show a couple weeks ago about the U.S. planning a space bomber so that we could bomb some city in Kosovo or wherever and be back to base in Missouri in 90 minutes. That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. Well, the Trekkies out there are going to be excited to hear the latest development, that scientists are working on building shields. You know, you got a tank, and the armor, the heavy plating on the tank to keep the tank safe from these tank killer missiles. You know, they've got 2-foot thick armor plating. Did you ever know that? Did you know 2-foot thick armor plating on a tank? And you know how much those tanks weigh? Well, in Britain, their Challenger tank weighs 60 tons. You try to move a few hundred of those halfway around the world in a hurry. 60-ton tanks because of the 2-foot thick armor. Well, what they're working on is shields. Instead of heavy armor, shields, like in Star Trek, like on Voyager, where they have electromagnetic pulses that melt and destroy incoming missiles. And they said the tanks, and apparently, now this is in the Observer, yesterday, Sunday paper in London, and they say that Britain and America are both working on this. The U.S. Army Research Laboratory in Aberdeen, Maryland, they've revealed details of how smart armor would work, but they say tanks, instead of 60 tons with the armor, could be reduced to 20 tons. I tell you, and Trekkies will be thrilled. They'll be thrilled. One step closer to Captain Kirk. All right, we're going to take a break, and we'll look for your calls at 800-8-N-YARDS and 303-463-1707.
Don't be thirsty. Drink from the living water. Don't be hungry. Eat from the bed of life. Don't be weary. You're stronger when you serve. Don't be defenseless. Carry the master's knife. Don't be thirsty. Drink from the living water. Don't be hungry. Eat from the bed of life. Don't be weary. You're stronger when you serve. Don't be defenseless.
We're back. We are back. Bob and Aaron Live, 1-800-8-N-YARDS. And we're going to go to the calls to California in a moment. But then there are two stories I'd like to talk about. One of the Kennedy cousins is facing trial for a murder back in 1975. And his defense attorney is arguing a statute of limitations had expired, 5-year statute, and he can't be prosecuted. I'd like to talk about that. And the New Jersey rabbi who's going on trial today, they began jury selection for murdering his wife. Well, he was conveniently at the synagogue in evening classes when she was bludgeoned to death by a delivery guy, two delivery guys. You know, he needed an alibi, so a week earlier he started going to evening classes. He was the senior rabbi. He didn't go to the evening Torah classes. But he went 2 weeks in a row so he'd have an alibi. And the guys who beat the wife to death, they pled, they went in, they admitted to it. They confessed. And the reason they confessed, they said, they didn't want him to get away with it. It looked like he was getting away with it. So, what do you know? Old-fashioned murderers coming clean for justice. Well, let's get to those stories. But first, on the phones, in Compton, California, Johnny, welcome to the show.
Hey, Bob, I'm back.
Howdy.
You gave me the invitation a few weeks ago.
I'm glad you called back.
Yeah. So you remember what we spoke about with Jane Fonda?
Yes.
Yeah. In any case, what it was...
Hey, Johnny, let me ask you to speak up.
Okay.
As loud as you can. And
is
we
this
wanna
fine
make sure,
right here?
Are you nice and close to the phone?
I am right up on
it. Good.
I'll tell you what. Let me move to a different phone.
Yeah, please do. Please move to a different phone. We'll bring you down for a second. Move to a different phone, and let me use this time to encourage all callers to all talk shows to call on your best phone and use a landline if you're at home. Don't use a cordless. Use a landline. And no speaker phones. Speaker phones, we automatically send a 250,000-volt response back through the phone line. Okay. And Johnny's calling from Compton, California. Perhaps an update on Jane Fonda. Johnny?
Hello?
Okay, Johnny.
Okay.
Johnny, that's 100% better.
All right, great. I was on a cordless phone.
All right.
All right. Now, no, this isn't an update on Jane Fonda. This is in regards to a past show when you said that Jane Fonda is saved even though she's a rabid pro board, and I didn't quite understand that.
Yeah.
Now, I have heard you make some comments about Hillary Clinton, about heaven,
right,
saying that heaven has no room for her
because
she would do when she got to heaven was start aborting angels.
Right.
Well, how
exactly.
Could you feel any different about Jane Fonda who donates millions of dollars, dozens of millions of dollars to a pro-abort agency? I don't understand that.
Right. Okay. Well, your question tells me a lot about your theology and my theology. Our theology is the reason why we might have a disagreement on this. Would you agree with that?
Not yet. You're going to have to support that because I look at that as the same as Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. Well, a murderer, you know, abortion is murder. So we're talking about murderers going to hell, right?
Yes.
Murderers go to hell. Unless they're forgiven of their sins. If they've humbled themselves somewhere along the line, then a murderer is forgiven and will go to heaven, even though he's a murderer, like King David and the Apostle Paul.
Well, no, I don't disagree with that. But the thing is that she made this donation
after she became a Christian. Right. Now, let me ask you a question about King David.
Okay.
Did he commit murder and adultery after he had become a believer or before?
That was definitely after.
Yeah. It was after. And now,
but he was repentant.
He was repentant. That's absolutely right. That's a great point. And Jane Fonda apparently is not repentant.
That's right.
Now, this is where we get to our what I think is a theological basis for maybe a disagreement. How long have you studied the Bible? For months, years, decades?
Well, seriously, just for a few years.
Okay. In your study of the Bible, have you found that God has made different covenants with men?
Yes.
And would you maybe be able to call one of those covenants the covenant of law or the Mosaic covenant?
That would be one. Yes.
That'd be reasonable, right?
Yeah.
And another one, perhaps, could be called the covenant of grace.
Yes.
And are those two covenants identical, or do you think they're substantively different?
No, they're different.
Right. Now, one thing I'd suggest to you to consider is that most of Christianity doesn't really differentiate between the covenant of law and the covenant of grace. They act as though they're both the same. And we today who believe, who are under the covenant of grace, we are taught as though we're under the covenant of law. And there is a huge difference between the two. The primary difference is when you're under the covenant of grace, you're no longer under the covenant of law.
Okay, so was the Apostle Paul, was he overstating his claim when he said that murderers and adulterers should be put to death?
No.
Or were worthy of death?
They should be.
Oh, you're saying they're worthy of it, but he's not saying that they should, that they shouldn't get into eternal life if they were saved.
Well, I would be happy if I was instructed by the government to execute Jane Fonda for supporting abortion. I'd be happy to do it. Just I would donate whatever, you know, bullets or rope or rocks or whatever was necessary, and I would do it. And just like the Apostle Paul said to Governor Festus in Acts 25, he said, if I've committed anything deserving of death, I do not object to dying. And a Christian could commit a crime and be punished by earthly authorities, but still maintain his standing before God as one forgiven and declared righteous because of what Jesus Christ has done, not because of what Paul had done, but because of what Christ had done.
Okay, Bob, well, can we compare Hillary Clinton again?
Yes.
I mean, Hillary Clinton, I believe both the Clintons claim to be Christians.
Right.
That there's no room in heaven because she abhorred angels.
Right, right. Much of the world claims to be Christian, just as in Christ's time, much of the world in Judea claimed to be, you know, a part of the chosen people. But they never knew God. They never knew the Father. And Jesus said, if you knew the Father, you would know me, and you'd believe in me. And so Hillary Clinton, when you look at her life, you could see that she has a visceral hatred for God. It's obvious. She's never humbled herself and said, I have become a Christian. I was rebellious. I was wrong. I'm sorry. And I've asked God to forgive me. She's never done that. Jane Fonda now says she attends the Providence Missionary Baptist Church in Atlanta, and she says that she had become a Christian. And when you become a Christian, that doesn't mean that your thinking is all corrected. What percentage of black churches support pro-abortion candidates? What's your guess on that, Johnny?
Oh, come on, Bob. I'm here in California. You know, I'm black myself.
Yeah.
Been in a ton of black churches. They support the pro-abortion, pro-homosexual Democrats down the line.
Right, right.
Even let them speak inside their congregation.
Absolutely. They think they're great. And I do not believe that all black ministers and all black churches are going to hell. I think many are going to hell, and many are truly saved, although they're trapped in ignorance because they don't know the Word of God, and because of legalism and self-righteousness, and corruption within the church, they're messed up. We're teaching a Sunday night, a Wednesday night Bible study now. We're in the book of 1 Corinthians. That whole book, Paul writes it to Christians who are severely messed up. They have all kinds of serious problems going on. And so when you become a Christian, that doesn't mean that you get all your thinking straight, all your public policy, all your moral and ethical questions you can now answer correctly, and all your theology's right.
Okay, well, besides saying that she attends this church, what has Jane Fonda shown you, or, you know, where you give her more a benefit of the doubt than Hillary Clinton?
Well, Hillary has not come out and said, I've recently converted to Christianity.
No, she said she was already a Christian.
Well, she said she's a Methodist.
Well,
to be a Methodist,
she believes that Jesus Christ came to save.
No, she doesn't.
Okay.
She does not believe that.
You know that, huh, Bob?
She sure never said that. The Methodists, they met in their national convention 5 years ago in Denver, and they said you don't have to believe in anything to be a Methodist. I mean, they voted on it in their convention, and it passed. It's official.
Well, that's their church.
Well, right, and Hillary Clinton has established that that's who she is. She's one of the pagans who happens to go, just on rare occasion, to church. You know, if the TV cameras are following her, and if her husband has that 5-pound Bible prop, then she goes to church. But she's not a Christian in any sense. I've never seen an example of her humbling herself to the Christ of the Bible.
Okay, and that's what we know that Jane Fonda did.
She did that publicly.
Okay.
And for her being such a radical feminist to come out, and we saw years ago, I mentioned Jane Fonda on Politically Incorrect about a year ago or 2 years ago before she publicly said she was saved. And I mentioned her saying that her whole life, she said that women were just as well off single as married. And then she publicly stated, this is maybe 5 years ago, that she was wrong. And she had never been happy until she became a wife. And when she said that, that knocked me off my seat. Because what humility and what a change of mindset it was to say that. And so then, a couple years later, she comes out and says she's a born-again Christian and that she got saved and she's going to church. And so the church she's going to undoubtedly is pro-choice. Would you agree with that, Johnny? It's a black church.
Well, not necessarily. Not necessarily. I mean, there are a lot of times when I think that you have a person, and even a famous person in the congregation, and they may have a different view, but a lot of times people are happy that they're attending the church and they don't want to be judgmental.
Well, right, but what I mean by that is that that church, there's no way that church condemns pro-choice leaders, the church she goes to.
Publicly, probably not.
From the pulpit.
Wouldn't be there.
From the pulpit, right.
Yeah.
So it's a church that would affirm Jesse Jackson and Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton. They'd even vote for Bill Clinton, for King if they could. And so she was converted by a liberal, immoral, but yet Christian inner city church. And I'm glad, like Paul said, some people preach the gospel out of greed, envy, and strife. He said, at least they're preaching the gospel. I'm glad she got saved. I think she did get saved.
Okay.
But I don't know her heart. I wouldn't bet my salvation on it. I wouldn't bet my salvation on it, but I think she's saved.
Well, for the record, inside your show, you did say that if she did this, then she was saved.
If she did it.
Yeah.
Yeah, if she professed her faith in Jesus Christ.
Right, exactly. So I think that is good enough, but yeah. I just thought it was a little consistent saying, you know, what you did about Hillary.
Right, and I'm so,
Johnny. But you clarified that. I see why you.
Yeah, I'm so glad you gave me the opportunity, because if you didn't give me the opportunity, there are hundreds of other people who would be wondering the exact same thing. Yeah. 1-800-836-9278, or you can call our backup line for tonight, 303-463-1707. All right. Hey, this Kennedy cousin who his trial, well, jury selection started today. No. That's the rabbi who murdered his wife, jury selection. The Kennedy trial, there's a pretrial motion by his defense attorney to throw the case out because Connecticut had a 5-year statute of limitations. Now, here's what happened. The Kennedy cousin, he's a cousin of the late Senator Robert F. Kennedy, and his name is Michael Skakel. And back in 1975, a 15-year-old girl named Martha Moxley was beat to death with a golf club. Now, that obviously, what a terrible and tragic thing to happen. This was in a wealthy neighborhood in Greenwich, Connecticut. And the golf club was traced to a set of clubs owned by the Skakel family. These are Kennedy cousins. And nothing has happened for 25 years. And now twice, courts have ruled that there is now enough evidence to proceed to trial. And so Michael Skakel is charged with murder, and his attorneys are trying to get the judge to throw the case out, because back in 1975, when the girl was beat to death, Connecticut had a mindless and ignorant law that had a 5-year statute of limitations for prosecution of all cases except death penalty cases. And since they are morons, they didn't have the death penalty for all murder cases. So beating a 15-year-old girl to death with a golf club apparently didn't qualify as a capital crime. And so his lawyers today are saying it should be thrown out. Now, the state law was changed in 1976 to eliminate time limits for prosecuting murder and other serious felonies. And that's as it should be. You know, the reason they have statutes of limitation is because they say, well, if you get charged with a crime years later, it's hard to defend yourself. Well, yeah, and it's also hard to prove the crime. Both are true. But if a videotape shows up of some guy raping a girl, murdering someone, committing a crime, and the videotape had been lost for 20 years, and there it is, and the guy raped a girl, are you going to let him go because a technicality? No. Justice needs to be paramount. The system should not let people go on technicalities. You don't get a get out of jail free card for some technicality. You don't even get a go to jail card. You just get a get executed card. So anyway, in this case, I'd like to bring you a couple quotes. Now, of course, Martha Moxley's mom, named Dorothy Moxley, says it would be a terrible injustice if this Kennedy cousin went free. Of course, you know, a wealthy, well-connected family avoids a trial on a technicality. Yeah, it'd be a terrible injustice. She's right, as a matter of principle. But let's talk about the law and what should happen. There's an article out on this by the Associated Press out today. Kennedy cousin trial faces dismissal. And they quote a lawyer, a law professor at the University of Connecticut, who says that the defense move is not a frivolous one. I think it's a solid legal argument. I think it really could go either way. Now, what should happen in this case? You know, in our shadow gov concept of where we teach people how a just government should function, we have a novel called The First 5 Days. In the first 5 days, on day two, after a Christian government takes over the country, and what will it do in its first 5 days? On day two, it executes everyone on death row. All death row inmates are executed, 3,000 of them. And the point is made in the novel. By the way, if you haven't read the novel, imagine there are people out there who have not read the account of Pat Schroeder being executed. I mean, it's one of those thrills in life, one of the ultimate fantasies that you can live. You talk about virtual reality. You want to know what it feels like to throw Pat Schroeder off the Royal Gorge Bridge. You got to read The First 5 Days. You just got to read it. It is a blast. It's really fun. Anyway, by the way, you can read that by calling 1-888-8-NYART, 1-888-8-NYART, and order it. First 5 days, not that expensive. We reduced all our prices when we went off TV. It's got to be a good rate. I forget the price. It's a good novel. At any rate, in there we make the point that when someone commits murder, they should be executed. But if the law of the land says we don't have the death penalty for murder, we only could put you in jail, then if a Christian government takes over, they can't retroactively go back and execute people who committed murder when the law said the penalty was jail. You can't do that. That's ex post facto, they call it. Now, why do they call it that? Because lawyers want job security, so they use Latin terms so people have no idea what they're talking about in court. I went to court and I said to the judge, I said, I'm going to represent myself. He said, well, that's very difficult. I said, yeah, but I want to do it. He said, well, do you think you could voir dire the jury? I said, voir dire? Do you mean, do I think I could ask them questions? And he said, yeah. I said, yeah, I could ask them questions. I just asked you a question. Why did he throw a little Latin in there, a little Latin lingo, a little lawyer liar lingo? Well, at any rate, those who believe in justice and are moral and ethical, they don't retroactively, they don't pass laws to apply them on people retroactively. And like Bill Clinton, he took office, he created a tax increase and passed it retroactively, and the Republicans in Congress voted for it. Well, I don't know how many, but a bunch of them. And so our government doesn't have any real big problem with that. But a Christian government should not punish people retroactively. So that brings up the question then, how about this Kennedy guy? Does he get away with it on a technicality? Because of our refusal to hold people to ex post facto legislation. A year after the murder, they changed the statute of limitations. A year after the murder, they changed it. So what is the right thing to do here? What is the right thing to do? Well, if it were me, if I were the judge, right now, if I was appointed judge with the authority that a judge should have over this case in Connecticut, Stamford, Connecticut. By tomorrow on prime time, Michael Skakel would be swinging from a noose. He'd be swinging from a noose. Because here's what's going on. If the state law, at the time he committed the murder, if the law said, well, if you murder someone, all that can happen is you go to jail. Well, then you can't execute him. But the state law didn't. That law that they're discussing, it didn't talk about the penalty. It talked about when you could be prosecuted. And he committed the crime not knowing at all when, if ever, he might be prosecuted. And then a year later, they changed when you could be prosecuted. And it was still within the statute of limitations. And they changed it. And that's not a law. That's a law that controls the government and the government's prosecution of a case. It's not a law that the defendant uses to calculate, let's see, statute of limitations, only 5 years. So I could kill this 15-year-old kid, and as long as I hide the evidence for 5 years, I'm okay. No, he doesn't consider that. That's not a motivating factor in his murder. But if a state says we don't have the death penalty, if you murder someone, all you do is go to jail and watch TV, then that does become a factor. That becomes a factor. The guy says, I like watching cable TV, and I hate this guy, and I'm going to kill him, and that's it. So the defense lawyers are saying, hey, this might seem very offensive to people, but the law is the law. Now, we're going to take a break here, but let me, right up to the break, let me let you in on a secret of what a Christian government would do. And this is not even in the first 5 days. This is so secret. In the first 5 days, we say we execute everyone on death row on day two of the Christian government. We execute them all. And that's so the rest of the time people will be good. And we do not execute anyone who committed a murder when the death penalty was not a possibility in states that had outlawed the death penalty. We don't execute them. But we could do this. We go back and look at all the murder cases where the convicted murderers were given jail time. And we see which of those cases could they have been executed. And then we reconsider those cases and we execute those criminals that should be executed. We do that. That's not in the book because it's a secret. So don't tell anyone.
They figured it out. You little blatantly shot. They don't need no savior. So for the fact, they say your life is inside. No need some prophet who died and rose again to save you. Grinding their axe for all their love and attacks. So don't you give them no facts, because their minds are made up, making no sense from either side of the fence. But still you get their two cents worth. Shape.
Hey, the federal government is spending your money. This is out of the Interior Department's budget. All right? Interior Department budget, $1 million for weed management at Montana State University. How's that one? And how about this? $150,000 to rehabilitate a barn at a wildlife refuge in New Hampshire. What else? What else do we have here? A $1.3 million for an Alaska Native American aviation training program. This is all in the Department of the Interior budget. Over $1 million for an Alaska Native American aviation training program. That's hysterical. I mean, it's racist to boot. How about this? $350,000 for the Chicago Wilderness Program. Chicago is the third largest urban area in the country. They got millions of people squeezed into a very narrow, smog-filled urban corridor. What wilderness program? Maybe they mean like the Saturday night gay bar scene. It might be an AIDS thing. And then I think I might have told you already about the Birmingham, Alabama, that the Interior Department is spending $3.5 million to refurbish a statue in Birmingham, Alabama, of Vulcan, the god of fire and iron. That's not made believe. That's real. You think that would violate the constitutional separation of church and state? Of course, there is no constitutional separation of church and state, but you think they would think it would. So anyway, what a trip. Okay. Now, the New Jersey rabbi. We've got an adulterous rabbi. He's having an affair with a talk radio host. How's that one? Named Elaine Sonchini. And his wife is beaten to death in their living room. And then you get a confession from a guilt-ridden private detective that says the rabbi offered him $30,000 to kill his wife. And so he's going on trial. Jury selection was set to begin today. In his defense, the defense attorney says, well, the rabbi has always denied being involved in any way with this, and he's looking forward to getting the matter behind him. He should take a different approach. He should claim full responsibility and put the matter behind him. I claim full responsibility. Now let's just move ahead. Let's just get on with our lives. So the rabbi's name is Fred Newlander, and he could become the first clergyman in New Jersey to receive the death sentence. And that's saying something. I grew up in New Jersey. The article here says that the Newlanders, the rabbi and his wife, were pillars of the community in Cherry Hill. Pillars of the community? Yeah, just like Lot's wife, I guess. That kind of pillar of the community. You know, Cherry Hill, that's where Operation Rescue started. That was one of their first big events. On November 1st, 1994, Carol Newlander was at home and her husband was at the synagogue sitting in on evening classes, something he had started doing just 2 weeks earlier. Senior rabbis don't sign up for the evening Torah classes at the synagogue. The doorbell rang at their home while the wife was talking to her daughter, Rebecca, on the phone. And Carol, the wife, said she would call her daughter back. But within the hour, the rabbi said he arrived home to find his wife's body in a pool of blood, her head beaten in with a pipe. What a terrible tragedy. And talk about a bizarre twist. One of the first to arrive on the scene was their son, Matthew Newlander, Matthew Newlander, 21 years old, because he worked for an ambulance crew. He was on an ambulance crew. He was an emergency medical technician, and he showed up at his own mom's murder. What a terrible story. So that was in November 1st, 1994. Now, it turns out he was dating a talk show host, Elaine Sonchini, and Elaine came forward, admitted she was having an affair with the rabbi, and the rabbi had promised him she wanted to marry him. He wouldn't divorce his wife. He said, "I can't divorce my wife. It would threaten my position at the synagogue." So he said to the other woman, he said, "Don't worry. I'll have the problem solved by your birthday in December." And now she comes forward and says this. And so he hires this private detective for $30,000. And the private detective, back in April of 2000, a year and a few months ago, he went to the Philadelphia Inquirer. That's their main newspaper out there. And with them, he arranged a meeting with the prosecutor. And he's 50 years old, and an acquaintance of his, a 27-year-old, took the money, and they posed as delivery men, and they beat the wife to death. And so he pled guilty to aggravated manslaughter, and he agreed, along with his accomplice, agreed to testify against Newlander. And he says that he came forward because he was afraid the rabbi would be acquitted. How's that one? The guy who does the murder says, "I don't want the husband to get away with it." So he confesses. It's bizarre. Absolutely bizarre. So the rabbi's been held without bail. But, you know, the tragedy is that confession came in April of 2000, and just today they're beginning jury selection. What were they doing all that time? What were they doing? I mean, the crime was already 5 years old. They're going into another statute of limitations. And they expect opening arguments on October 15th. What are they going to do between now and then? What's going on? You know, that's why our federal law has something right when they say a speedy trial right is not for the defendant, it's for the victims. That's right. You got to wait all this time? It's ridiculous. So where did my show go? Where did the show go? Look at the time. This is horrendous. I didn't even get a chance to get to the story I wanted to get to that I started a couple weeks ago about the judge in Ventura, California, who ordered parents to support their loser son. They got a loser son, and the judge orders the parents to support him. And you know how much money they say they got to give him? This is going to blow your mind. They got to give him $3,500 a month for living expenses, because he's an alcoholic. And he's 50 years old. The son is 50 years old. And the judge ruled the parents have to support him indefinitely. Well, I guess they could stop supporting him when they die, I guess. So, Judge Melinda Johnson. Judge Melinda ruled that James and Bertha Culp of Ventura pay their son David Culp $3,500 a month because he's incapable of supporting himself. Now, they had a trailer park when they, and now they're retired, the parents. And the Culps are appealing, of course. And this is the first ruling of its kind in California. Now, David Culp, the son, graduated from Stanford University. All right, now, granted, right there, that's evidence that he's a moron. but he should be able to scrape by. Then he practiced family law in Ventura County for 19 years. Now, granted, that's additional evidence that he's a moron. And he was earning, and at his peak earning potential, he was making about $120,000 a year as a divorce lawyer. Right? And then he got emotionally upset. And he started abusing people in court. And he started throwing furniture. And he just got angry. And so he quit his law practice. And so now the parents have to take care of him indefinitely, $3,500 a month, so he can become a full-time alcoholic. Now, believe it or not, California's law states this. California's law, Family Code, Section 3910, Paragraph A. The father and mother have an equal responsibility to maintain a child of whatever age who is incapacitated from earning a living and without sufficient means. The California lawmakers are idiots, huh? And the judge is an idiot. And the former lawyer's an idiot. But hey, he was a lawyer and he knows what the family law code says. So he's cashing in. This is Bob Enyart reminding you to do right, stay out of California, and risk your consequences.